Welcome to Idle Red Hands, a podcast from Japan about gaming and gamer life. And welcome to Idle Red Hands. I'm Chris.
I'm Wayne.
I'm Lyle.
This is Idle Red Hands!
Yeah, because I didn't miss that intro.
It's been a while since we had that one.
Yeah.
Was it Hoplites?
Yeah.
Yeah. And we never asked for it back. All right, this is part two of our discussion of the tabletop role-playing game industry survey that was circulated at the end of last year. And last episode we talked about, you know, things that didn't surprise us. And this episode is going to be about things that did surprise us, as well as what we see as the future, looking at the information. Before we move on to part two, there is at least one thing I want to clarify about part one, and that was when I was talking about people and their kids, and they're getting their kids to start playing role-playing games. And in my effort not to kind of bring that down or the expectations down, I didn't want people thinking I was downplaying the impact that will have. Because certainly with all the games, you know, war games or when a role-playing games first kicked off, you do need those pioneers that then sort of kick off the trend and then share it and start those connections. The ground zero of role-playing games in an area. What I was just saying, though, is that you also need to go beyond the family ties and get people picking it up in stores on their own and that for it to really grow.
Right.
Well, yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. With that, if it only continues in family trends, you know, you'd think the best you could kind of get would be a one-to-one thing, because some people would have more than one kid, but some people wouldn't have any kids, and not all the kids would pick up the hobby, too. So it'd just be slow diminishment of the fan base, if that were the case. But, you know, actually, that was something, if you don't mind me jumping right into the topic then, that was one of the things that surprised me about the survey, was looking at the answers for age. There was only in four different questions that related to age, things like what is your age and what is the age of people in your group, there was only one respondent that answered under the age of 18. And that was rather disheartening, actually, to see, because there don't seem to be that many young people in the hobby. Now, granted, of course, this could be somewhat biased from our samples, if only people who are listening to, say, us old guys or posting on the forums that we go to, it might not represent all of the gamers, but still, not to have any more than one person say they're under the 18, that's... Eek.
Absolutely, and that was that information, and compared that to the ages when people actually picked up and started playing the game.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
Yeah.
That stuff made the main paper, saying this is really disturbing.
Yeah.
Or this disturbing, or this is a concern for the industry, is that people start playing this game very young, but there are no young players.
Right.
So the over 50% of the people played 17 or under, and under 25% started over 18 or older.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So, I mean, if you don't have those people playing now, and that also gets into when we talk about like the people that are going to introduce the game to other people, I mean, sure, tabletop role-playing games does cross certain age barriers somewhat, or more so than other activities, but you're still not going to have 10-year-olds playing too often with 20-year-olds or 30-year-olds.
Yeah, their parents won't let them.
Right. Yeah.
Right.
But also another point along with that is that this game requires a certain amount of market saturation in order to work, because you don't play by yourself. You need to have enough people in a nearby area to play along with.
Yeah,
granted,
absolutely.
Online helps with that, but I reckon it. I don't think it could survive as an only online hobby with the way the current technology is.
Right, and also there's the good side of peer pressure in a way. I mean, this is not smoking or drugs or alcohol.
Right.
Although it's been portrayed
or
in
know
a similar
what,
way at
You
times,
know what? Those things might actually be cheaper in some cases.
This is far more addictive, too.
But it doesn't matter how cool something is. If somebody older is introducing it to you, that might be perceived as uncool. And I remember when I was like a youth group volunteer, and I brought my music, and that would be things like Weezer. And we were playing that and listening to that. And then one of the kids said, Okay. Does anybody have any cool music to listen to? And I'm like,
now you know how I feel. How's that?
It's like, this is Weezer. It's just, I was older listening to older music, and that's just not cool.
I'm not a child psychologist, or, you know, but I think that is only for kids above a certain age. When you start getting into like teenage and beyond, then older things or things that are introduced to you by older people become uncool. I think under a certain age, maybe like 13, 12 and under, then it's really cool because, I don't know, adults are still kind of cool.
But then the actual products that people play with are too complex for those kids. If you look at kind of average,
yeah.
I agree 100%. But 47% of the respondents said that they started between the ages of 12 and 17.
Right.
And those are the ages when you didn't like hanging out with your parents.
Exactly.
You're really self-conscious.
Right.
The opinions of your peer group mean a lot. Mm. And yeah, like people under 12, they're a lot less jaded.
Mm. Yeah.
A lot
yeah.
more receptive to being introduced to things by their parents or their older brother. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, if they're handing them over like 500-page Pathfinder rule book.
Right.
I mean, the little wrists are going to break.
Yeah.
One thing.
Actually, that kind of gets into another point if you don't mind moving on to it. Or do you have
what, calcium?
No, calcium.
Yeah. Yeah. So that.
Broken wrists, actually. But
well, I was going to say something about the age group that, like, as we said, like 42% of the respondents are age 35 to 40. And the majority of people started playing when they were 12. And as you said, Chris, only one person for the survey said that they were under 18. Mm-hmm. I think something to think about is, when we started gaming, what were the alternatives compared to the alternatives now? I'm not saying that's the only reason for the low number of young respondents, but I mean, when we started playing, video games were kind of crap, and you know, that we didn't have all the high tech, to make myself sound incredibly old, alternatives that kids do now. So
well, I agree 100%.
When we wanted to play video games, they looked like blocks, and we were happy with that.
or you know what? Even if you weren't happy with it, what was the alternative? Hey, not much.
Going outside?
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah.
For those of us who didn't want to go outside.
for us pale-skinned folk. yeah.
Yeah. But no, I just wanted to say that because I don't – while it is I think it's a factor and – Maybe it's not a large one, but
yeah.
I do definitely agree that this is kind of a concerning trend, but I don't think it's only that young people simply are not playing.
No, absolutely. I mean, there's a reason why people aren't playing, and it's not because they've become healthier and are playing more sports. I mean, there's factors that should play right into the tabletop role-playing games, like the increasing obesity. That should be great. but... we talked about like the play patterns last episode and just, yeah, they're not playing, they're playing other games, and those games are becoming games to them. Those games are becoming role-playing games to them, which is, I've had to change how I speak calling these tabletop role-playing games to anybody but
tabletop somebody who plays Pathfinders.
Yeah, because just so people know that so I don't have to go, no, not WoW.
Yeah, exactly.
Or, not Knights of the Old Republic, which actually dates me since that's an old game now. But
Right. No, you're right. We pretty much have to say pen and paper RPG or tabletop RPG or traditional RPG because it's something else.
Yeah, because the competition has now co-opted the actual term.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. And we touched upon what other people have written. So that, like Ryan Dancy was talking about the play patterns. Different books were talking about sort of the innovations introduced by the traditional role-playing games and whether or not they still possess them. So there is hope and there is that potential.
Well, you know, actually something that you mentioned a few minutes ago was about, you know, these little kids getting handed these huge core book and breaking their wrists. No connection to the breaking their wrists, but the core book was another one of the things that surprised me about the survey. It was that 61% of respondents said that their first book, what initially got them into the game, was the core book. That was the first thing they got. Mm-hmm. You know, it was a little bit different back in the day, because for me, too, it was also the core book, but I was with the D&D Redbox set, so it was only about as thick as a heavy magazine. So it wasn't, you know, a 500-page monster like some of the rule books today, but still, it might be something to say. Maybe the rules might not be as big a barrier as we say.
Well, I'm going to disagree, because I wasn't surprised. Sorry, Wayne. Mm-hmm.
No, you're probably going to take my point, so go right ahead.
Yeah. I think there's a few things at play there. One is the kind of the division that happened with Dungeons and Dragons, where people see basic game and they think they're not getting a full game.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas they see advanced Dungeons and Dragons and that has the appearance of being a deluxe Dungeons and Dragons. So they figure they buy that book, they've got the whole game.
Mm-hmm.
Also, at the time, I mean, introductory box sets are only now enjoying a little bit of a resurgence.
Uh-huh.
And for a long period of time, they just weren't available. So when something like White Wolf releases Vampire the Masquerade, there's not an introductory box set to Vampire the Masquerade.
Hmm.
And that was part of the early 90s wave of role-playing games. So those were your only options.
Hmm.
Some, for example, Torg, it was a box set, but that was the core book. So I think it gets down to what were the options available. You either bought the core book, you bought nothing. And then sometimes when they're side by side, like the introductory box set versus something that's called Advanced Dungeons & Dragons, one looks like a complete game, and one looks like it's half the game.
Hmm. So yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah, it's kind of what I was going to say, because, I mean, the question was, what was the first tabletop role-playing game product that you bought? And yeah, 61% of respondents said the core book. As Lyle said, kind of introductory box sets weren't that prolific back in the early 90s, but mm-hmm. I also looked at it as more of, okay, you are going to buy this thing. Who is going to buy something that is an incomplete game?
Yeah, who would actually start themselves on a supplement or something?
Exactly,
like that.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, maybe you did because your DM friend had the core set, and so all you needed was, like, the player's handbook or whatever, but I think that didn't surprise me because I thought most people will say, I want to play this game. What do I need to play this game? Hey, the core book. Okay, I'll get it.
Yeah, you're absolutely right.
Yeah, and a lot of role-playing games do present the core book as the self-contained book.
Right.
That's everything you need. Only a few games such as Dungeons & Dragons had it where everything's really separate.
Right.
Yeah. Right now, though, I think companies are getting better at presenting the introductory game. So, printing is better and more sophisticated.
Also print on demand.
Sure. They also realize the appeal of color and having extra goodies inside it. Certainly Fantasy Flight games, although I don't think it was a big success, really tried to push that with a game like the Warhammer Fantasy role-playing game,
mm-hmm.
where it was a $100 box
right,
with a lot of different things in it, so it was almost like a board game.
Right.
Yeah, and I think it failed, but it was good that they tried to do that experiment. I think they have to go back to just releasing normal books.
I mean, there's also a little bit in there, the question about, like, even though you wrote core book, some people may be looking at the D&D model and thinking that trilogy of books is the core book.
In my mind, it is. It's kind of the core set.
Right.
One thing that really surprised me about the results was the limited impact of licensing.
Hmm. Really?
I thought licensing would have a major impact on somebody's purchasing decision. So when you license something like Star Wars or Star Trek or Marvel or DC, there's certainly the gamble because the licensing is going to add more to the cost of the product, but it would pay off because people would be more likely to buy it. And the results did not bear that out.
That's odd because that doesn't actually surprise me. It was just about 50-50, wasn't it?
Yeah, roughly.
Hmm. Yeah. And that's the kind of thing for me, too. For me, it's much more important just how good the game, the mechanics, the story, the setting as well, that's kind of included in the licensing. But all of that is more important compared to whether it's something known or famous already. So I mean, it's just kind of anecdotal, but the way I feel kind of aligns with what the survey represented.
Huh. Yeah, I don't know what to make of that, like, because 74% of respondents said that they are not more likely to buy a game just because it's attached to a license such as like Star Wars or Marvel or something like that. I don't know. Maybe that's people saying, you know what, we'll play anything provided it seems interesting and is fun.
I'm going to say, you know, you get results back and you got to interpret them. People don't want to admit that certain things sway them. So, but seriously, X-Wing, would anybody be excited about a generic spaceship fighter game? I don't think so. I think people got, oh, there's a new Star Wars game.
Right.
Everybody gets excited about it. Not everybody, but people get excited about it. People talk about it. People post, share. So certainly it helps as far as spreading the word about the game. And then when people look at the ships that they recognize, the X-Wing fighter, the TIE fighter, people are going to go, wow, you know, I want to buy that more than they would about generic starfighters. Now, this also could be my personal bias. And from my anecdotal evidence, where people got myself and some gamer people I know, they get really excited because they like Star Wars.
Right.
So they go and buy a game that they haven't played before, like non-miniature gamers, and they go and buy this game and they get really into it. But I would imagine that there's a reason why an established superhero game such as Mutants and Masterminds saw some value in getting the DC license to have a DC game.
Right.
Yeah, I agree totally. Though I said the opposite thing, there's a very big point to be had that a lot of companies pay for licenses, and that wouldn't be the case if they weren't profitable. So,
I mean, look at Fantasy Flight Games, and their role-playing line is almost entirely or entirely based on licenses that they purchased. Either the Games Workshop IPs,
right,
or Star Wars. And
Margaret Weiss, that's their entire business model.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it failed with Marvel, but for whatever reason, I mean, they can't get into the details, but yeah, I look at this, the answer to this, and I would be tempted to just reject it and saying there was something about it. This is not, doesn't reflect reality.
Mm. Well, then
and sometimes you do that. You get the results of a survey, and you said, like, people, you know, it's like if you ask a question, are you racist? Why? And then people go like, well, no, I don't think I am. And this was my "Are you racist?" question.
Oh, really? I was going to say I don't think it was that divisive. You know, would...
No, but people I think go, no, I'm not influenced by that, and I'm going to say, yeah, you are.
Mm.
Sorry. Well, like D&D. Like D&D is a
brand now.
It's a brand, and people are getting this is not D&D, and people get all excited about D&D, and people are going to buy D&D next, not because it's the latest fantasy game on the block. People are buying it because it's the latest D&D game.
Right, right.
So, whether or not they're willing to pay more, I sure, 50-50, I think that might be more accurate, I guess.
Yeah, I was going to ask if you thought that was a more accurate question, because it's like a 50-50 split, yeah.
Yeah, but 74-26, no way. Perhaps, maybe if I, again, looking at as a flawed question, perhaps if it had said branding.
Mm.
Or the brand name of the company as opposed to licensing. But I was looking for whether or not companies should continue to look at licensing other properties in order to cross over into other groups and to appeal to people outside of the role-playing community. So again, a flaw there in that people within the role-playing community are answering this question.
Right.
But what it was going for was seeing the impact of licensing and then would be using that information to project in how valuable acquiring a license would be to getting shelf space at a Toys R Us and things like that, and attracting somebody who is not interested in role-playing games but is interested in, let's say, Star Wars.
Right. Because, like, Chris brought up Margaret Weiss Productions, and you did too, Lyle, and they recently released the new Firefly role-playing game. Again, as you said, it's kind of and not flawed, but we can't gauge how much interest that product garnered outside of the role-playing game hobby because, you know, we kind of only had role players answering the questions. But I would imagine that the whole thing Margaret Weiss does is by, you know, licensing Smallville, Leverage, Marvel, Firefly, Battlestar Galactica, is they're hoping to get people that know about this thing but are not necessarily gamers, as well as, I'm sure that if you did a Venn diagram of people who like those things and are gamers, there'd be significant overlap, but it's not going to be like a total overlap. So I think the whole reason they go for licensing the products the way that they do and brands that they do is to try and draw people in.
Oh, absolutely. Or they could be just trying to grab as much of the current gamer community as they can.
True.
With something like Firefly, Leverage or Smallville, I can see that having more crossover appeal.
Mm-hmm.
Battlestar Galactica, people liked Battlestar Galactica without liking role-playing games.
Right.
So, yeah. I should have said what results surprised or angered you, because I'm a little passionate about this.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So, another one, and I'm going to say surprised. But I guess I wasn't really that surprised. I just, using my own experience, I shouldn't be that surprised. But yeah, I was a little bit surprised in, like, where do you primarily play face-to-face? Mm. And 88% at one of the players' homes, mm-hmm. which actually killed one of the ideas I had about whether or not, if people are playing in gaming stores or conventions, or whether or not there could be some sort of business model that could be generated from there. And the part of that was related to the music industry and how music's less about buying the music and more about advertising the artists. So you go to their concert and pay a lot of money.
Right.
And that's where they make a lot of their money. So that's why people like Radiohead and other artists, they can experiment with, hey, let's release it for free and you just pay me whatever. Mm. And even unknown artists were like, yeah, sure, share that song. Post it on YouTube. Mm. Here's our latest song from our latest album. You know, a lot of people buy the digital albums, but they're probably also counting on, oh, and we're going to be here in May. So come and check us out.
Right. Mm. Well, do you think that answer is because there currently isn't really anything that does that for the RPG hobby, as opposed to people are unwilling to do that?
That's a really good question. And only recently, and I was listening to another podcast, Thaco, mm-hmm. and they were talking about, I think it was something along the lines of Future of the Hobby. It's one of the more recent episodes. And they were talking about playing in a gaming store and whether or not they did that. And people not buying stuff from their local, what is it, local favorite gaming store?
Oh, Friendly Local Gaming Store.
Oh, okay. Yeah. See, we live in Japan, so we got to order online anyway. So
yeah, not so friendly or local.
Yeah, so it means nothing to us.
And you know, that was the how high the percentage of people who bought offline was a surprise for me as well.
Okay. Well, hold that thought. Let me just finish about the Thaco guys. And of course, they can just walk down, go a few blocks. Or they're pretty close to the gaming stores, but they're just saying that, like, they're closing down. They're not as common. Hmm. And they were thinking is that instead of the gaming stores moaning about that, is they need to be a bit more proactive in what they do and what kind of service they offered. And I thought, yeah, that. So right now, currently, yeah, sure, this reflects the reality, as you said, Wayne. And there's nothing enticing about going to your game store to go play, unless if you already have friends and a home to play in.
Right.
But they were saying making these major events and other things that you could do, it'd probably be better to listen to their episode on it. But that, it kind of made me think, and it's like, yeah, the gaming stores need to kind of combine different things in order to make going to the gaming store a real event and a real place to be.
Right. I've never actually played in one, but apart from, Dungeons & Dragons organized play, like the Encounters and Friday Night Delves or whatever they have, I can't really think of anything for an RPG that is similar. Again, I haven't played in one, but I kind of assumed that at least the D&D organized play was, you don't have a group because for whatever reason, maybe no one around you plays, so come to the store and play. And right. I always took it as, and hopefully you're going to meet people and eventually form a group.
And not have to go to the store to play.
Pretty much. I mean, that may not be their ultimate goal, but that is kind of what I picked up. So
it's like a means to an end.
Yeah.
Whereas you go to a concert not hoping to meet concert goers, but to enjoy that experience. And yeah, this is what the Thaco people are talking about. And this is what I was thinking of, but I didn't make the jump to the gaming stores need to do more, because I'm just looking at the results going, nope, I guess that's not an option. Mm-hmm. They need to be in events in and of themselves. They need to be an end.
It may just be the format of what a role-playing game is, where I would really have to sit down and think about how a role-playing game could do that, especially when you compare that to something like Magic, where it's very easy to organize those tournaments, in a game store, and then people have a reason to go and play, because you can, do some kind of like prize pack where, so many people play, the store gets some kind of prize pack, and you get something for winning. Role-playing games generally don't have a winner, so you kind of can't follow that model. So I don't know what you could offer.
This group drank the most Mountain Dew. Congratulations.
Well, yeah, exactly. I don't know what a store could offer, really, apart from a celebrity DM.
Sure, like, not necessarily a celebrity DM, but just a very good game master.
Right.
I mean, I think people might get into the car to travel a little bit there. Again, the experience, like, I don't know if people were, like, had like movies in the background or something like theme nights, different things that you could do. You think about the mom mentality. If more people are dressing up, you might be inclined to do it. Mm. Maybe not walk down the street like that, but I don't know. But there's certainly something that could be explored. There could be just a raffle as opposed to a competition. Mm. You're all entered into some sort of draw at the end and you win something, but it becomes something to look forward to every week.
So basically that sounded, at least the suggestions you were spitting out there, it sounds more like the store needs to promote itself rather than necessarily the hobby. Like it wouldn't have to be something linked to role-playing games, just something to get people to come out and play.
Sure, yeah. Now I was thinking about whether it could share some of the economics or some of the revenue stream. Perhaps not, but at least making it a place where people come and to buy, or perhaps, I don't know, maybe they would pay a monthly fee if it was offering something more than just books on a shelf and bare tables. I don't know, people are playing more with battle mats than that. With miniature games, you might go to a store just so you can play on the scenery. Or
that was the draw for me when I was still doing Warhammer back in the States. It was, you know, let's go play on those nice tables down at the Games Workshop.
Mm. Yeah, so if they offered nice terrain in which you could do your Pathfinder or D&D game, then that's good. If they had something where somebody can go in and play like a White Wolf game and it's everything about the store is offering to the atmosphere, then sure, maybe that's it.
Yeah, well, if you're going to go play Vampire, just go play in the Hot Topic. Because as soon as you said White Wolf and atmosphere, I'm like, so they're going to put like Fog
store.
Machine and... Yeah.
Is it good fog?
No, but I was thinking, like, okay, what do you got to do to vampire this place up? No? All right.
Well, one of the other things that I noticed on it was, it wasn't a single question, but it was kind of a combination of several questions that a lot of people ranked the rules of a game as one of the highest reasons that they would either be interested in the game or not. Question number 25 was where it kind of really kicked in for me, is where it was talking about, do you prefer other games to role-playing games? And of course, the majority didn't say yes, but for those that did, the game that they prefer most was video and computer games. And then the reasons for that was how easy it is to get started and how much less time it takes to actually play, which seems to lean into just the amount of rules that you have to learn for it. So when we podcast here, we tend to minimize the mechanical aspects of game, but I was surprised at just how highly rules ranked as something that seemed important to people who took the survey.
I wouldn't be so surprised by that. I know what you're saying, but I would say rules are important to me as well, but maybe from a different perspective. I don't need rules for a lot of things. I like really simple rules that I can learn quickly that seems to cover a lot of stuff, but not exhaustive. Mm-hmm. So it's important to me, but I want them simple and easy.
Yeah.
So I can see many people saying that rules are important, but for many different reasons.
Exactly. Yeah, I agree. Because I tend to feel the same way with you. You know, I think Pathfinder is a fantastic system, but as we discussed a couple of weeks ago, it's far too rule heavy for me to really want to play right now.
So just to clarify, Chris, when you said that, when you're saying that you were surprised at how important the rules seem to be, did you mean in kind of like a negative sense, where, as you said, a large percentage of people who answered, yes, I play other games, and then most of them said video games, and then again a large percentage of people said that the reason they like video games is they're easy to get into, which you're interpreting as rules can break a person, essentially, or kind of deter them from playing? Is that what I'm getting?
Well, I mean, that is an aspect to it, yes, but that's not the main reason I was thinking of it. The main reason was because a lot of this survey is talking about kind of the marketability of different gaming products, so a lot of the questions focus on what would get you to buy something, or what would you be interested in purchasing, and along with those, just the how high the rules ranked was surprising to me. Because when somebody's looking at a gaming product, or at least when I am, I look, of course I skim through the rules for it, but it's not a section that I read very heavily before actually deciding to buy a game.
Right.
I think that's actually a really good point, and I can think of like purchases that I've made. Mm-hmm. The one that's most crystallized in my mind is The Vampire the Masquerade,
right.
where I had never heard of that game until I picked it up in the store, and it was the section on the clans as opposed to anything on combat that sold me. So in other words, setting sold me on that game, and I picked it up, whereas something when I went and bought Torg, or it was because it came as a recommendation from the guy, because he subscribed to the idea that friends don't let friends play Rifts.
Yeah. Right.
So he's like, well, why don't you buy this game instead? It's better.
Right.
DC Heroes, I just wanted to play superheroes and DC superheroes. So, yeah. So I can see that. So maybe, again, that factors into they're maybe hearing the rules or they're trying out the rules.
Mm-hmm.
So they play Savage Worlds, and then they play Fate, and then they decide, oh, I like Fate better because of the rules. So they go and buy it.
Yeah, and I think it may have to do with the way that people are get into games. I think some 61% of respondents said that they got into games because they were introduced by a friend. And I imagine that carries on to when you choose to purchase a new game, is you've played it with friends or it's been recommended by friends.
Good point. You know the rules.
Exactly.
Right.
Also, like maybe another way that this could have been interpreted was that I don't like making rules.
Yeah.
Whereas I might like making a setting. And a lot of people do have the homebrew games. So when they buy something, they buy it for the rule set.
Mm-hmm. Right.
They don't buy it because it's attached to this particular fantasy setting.
Mm-hmm.
Because they can make that on their own.
True, world building was a very popular activity according to the survey.
Yeah, you could also look at it like a different way. What I initially thought of was, well, rules, at least to me, are the kind of the main thing that differentiates one RPG from another. Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, yeah, setting, of course, sets things apart, but what's to separate one Tolkien-esque fantasy game from another Tolkien-esque fantasy game, and that is primarily, at least for me, the rules. So I can see the rules being important, and you know, as you guys said, you're introduced, the majority of people are introduced to role-playing games by a friend, and then you're already going to be exposed to a couple of systems, and that will probably inform, you know, what kind of games you like, just because you're getting that at a early age in your role-playing game career. But then you reach, like, a certain point, like, I'm drawing a blank on the name right now, but I recently downloaded some space opera game from DriveThruRPG. And I'm like, okay, you know what? The setting here looks cool. Not exactly thrilled about the system. I could run this in Ubiquity, something I already know. And I think that might be something, too, where it's like you kind of crystallize or have your favorite rule sets, and there comes a certain point where you're like, I like the setting. I know this other system over here a lot better, and so I'm just going to use those rules.
Redo it, yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, and what it comes down to, it, I feel the exact same way as you do, Wayne. I'm a mechanics junkie, too. So I say what I said in opposition to my actual feeling, right. too.
And it also could be because rules, again, for me, kind of make or break a game, where, you know, a really good or a really well put together game, I very much feel the rules will support the type of game being played, where kind of like a meteoric one. It's just like, okay, these rules just kind of simulate reality, but they don't do anything in terms of genre or tone. So, yeah. Not really surprised that rules are then important. One of the things that I guess maybe it didn't surprise me, but I found it interesting, was the number of people who looked at RPG-related material on a tablet computer. It was a pretty low percentage. I mean,
it's smaller than I expected.
Yeah, exactly. It was kind of smaller than I expected. Yeah, only 16% said that they looked at digital RPG products on a tablet computer. However, more than half of the respondents, 54%, said that they would like to access their digital products with a tablet computer. But only about a third, 33%, said they had a tablet computer.
Yeah, so you gotta get this data to a Mac.
Exactly. So it wasn't so much as surprisingly, it didn't so much surprise me from like an RPG standpoint, as more of a, here is a market for the tablet computer. And I guess by extent, like, if so many people, or if such a high number of people, want to use a tablet to view their role-playing game material, I think publishers need to start taking that into account. I think we kind of mentioned it in our Numenera review, possibly the last episode as well, where we were talking about how hyperlinked everything was and how easy it mm-hmm. was to navigate. And it was specifically designed for a tablet, or maybe not specifically designed, but it was definitely designed with tablet use in mind. And another PDF for a Fate game called Nova Praxis was specifically designed to be viewed on a tablet, and every single page had built into the design of the page a table of contents and a thing to jump back and forth between the chapters. And I don't know, I think that's something that publishers should really start taking into account.
Yes and no, because then there's the question, would you be more likely to buy a tablet computer if TRPGs were to offer more digital features? And 68% said no. So people wouldn't, it's almost like, if I had a tablet computer and I had the choice between my desktop, laptop, and that, I'll choose my tablet computer. But it's not going to affect my purchasing decision. So it's not influencing the number of tablets in the market. And certainly from a tablet maker perspective, you wouldn't see the role-playing community as being sizable enough to cater to.
Yeah, fair enough, yeah.
And it seems like from the role-playing company perspective, if no matter how many features they give their product, it's not going to force them to switch to something that's going to be able to use it.
Mm.
Yeah, there's no incentive to do it.
Yeah, kind of no point. Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah. I mean, these kind of like when products are tied together in this way is, you know, you need one to make a move before the other.
Right. And in the survey, people did kind of rate audio or PDFs with fancy bells and whistles other than hyperlinking.
Yeah.
They ranked those pretty low in terms of whether they would be willing to buy them. So.
And we talked about it last episode, but these are things as people might have trouble visualizing what it is or what it could do. And you know, maybe I have trouble visualizing what the potential is as well. So if people saw it and used it and go, yeah, I like this more,
well, you know,
then
they
might do it.
The question was more on would you be more willing to buy a PDF if it had these bells and whistles, but also the questions relating to what do you think would make these PDFs more accessible, these digital products more accessible. I think the largest one was having videos inside the PDFs.
Yeah.
So maybe it's a case of people want this, they just don't know what it would look like yet.
Or they want it but don't want to pay for it.
Fair enough, yeah. Maybe instead of like game books or PDFs, like a large percentage of people said that for at least for digital tools, they would like character and adventure builder applications.
Mm, yes.
So,
which I totally agree with. Every game should have an online character builder.
I'm not going to disagree. And if you're playing a game like Pathfinder, then it would definitely help. But I'm kind of in the same boat as Lyle, where I prefer slightly more simple games, and then I kind of like being able to actually have the thing in my hand.
But you can't pull out a book at work.
Yeah, but it's also hard to read in the tiny screen and do anything really at work.
I have a huge screen, sorry.
Yeah. And do you use all of it for work time while you're doing this?
And does your boss sit directly behind you?
Yeah, there's that. There you go.
I hope he's not listening to this cast.
Since we're talking about this, because it's near the questions, I was surprised, but then when I saw people expanding upon the answer, I understood where they were coming from, but people just weren't keen on subscriptions.
Mm.
And this question was influenced by the comic book model, in particular what Marvel does, where they offer a subscription service and you can read their backlog of comics, and D&D did it.
Yeah, they did.
And
they did
a subscription, maybe less successful than Marvel. But people didn't see that as very appealing, and they also didn't see it as appealing for new players. But the justifications they offered, I think, made a lot of sense. One of them being people might be more likely or more willing to spend something for one thing and walk away with it than commit to a subscription. And a lot of this might be influenced by the fact that some subscriptions are designed to, hey, it will automatically renew you.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're just you know, for your...
Yeah, unless you tell us otherwise. Yeah, unless you tell us otherwise, we're going to keep taking this money from you every month.
Yeah.
Whether you want us to or not.
Yeah, I think I end up paying for 2 extra months of World of Warcraft just because you're like, oh, yeah, I guess I'll try it again.
Right.
Yeah. And so I had a free month.
DDI quite a few months after we stopped playing D&D.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
But, you know, also I think it's a little bit different from the comic industry in that the gaming industry has editions to it. You know, getting access to all of the first edition D&D magazines is not quite as helpful as, you know, getting access to, say, the early 70s comic books. You know, the comic books, the stories are still good, the stories are still there, but all of the mechanical elements of those magazines aren't really useful anymore.
Yeah, yeah, no, absolutely. This could be a situation where what's currently available for a subscription service with role-playing games is certainly not what could be available for role-playing games, and certainly not what is available for comic books.
Right.
Like, one thing that you might need to do to go on what you were saying, Chris, is like offering adventures and different edition versions of it.
Hmm.
So you have, so you bring in all the Dungeons & Dragons players from all the different editions, and they can play against the giants first, second, third, or fourth.
That's kind of maybe a bit of a tangent here, but that seems to be what Wizards is trying to do with this latest round of encounters. I may have gotten that wrong, but from reviews of products, recent products I've listened to, what you kind of get is the adventure, but with no stats. And what they say is, go online to get the stats for the edition that you are going to play.
You know,
it sounds like it, but from what I, the few reviews I heard, people didn't like that.
Well, I think maybe they might not like buying one thing.
Right.
And then having going online to get the rest of it.
Right. That was kind of the thing. It's like, a lot of people said, we understand what you're doing. You're making this so that everybody can buy this one thing and then play regardless of the edition. We feel like we are getting less.
Yeah, so, but if you had, for example, a subscription service monthly, and you have access to anything in the library, and then you don't feel like you're having to go to two places. It's there for you to access. You can read it. One thing with comic books is that you use a particular reader.
Right.
So I'm sure people can break it, but I'm not one of those people, so you just read it and you don't have it.
Right.
So you have to buy it separately if you want to do that. So they would need a particular reader where you would have to be in front of your computer to access the product, but
right,
and that things like that might shift people more towards tablets, because one thing we didn't mention when we talked about the tablet question is that most people still use their PDFs on their desktop.
Hmm.
And I'm one of those people, but I don't know why, because I have a laptop, and why wouldn't I just walk a few feet and sit somewhere more comfortable?
Right. Bigger screen, maybe, at least for me. Like, I don't have a tablet, but I can view stuff on my phone, and it's just easier to look at the bigger screen.
Yeah, tablets are heavy. It's hard to lay down and read one. I've got two. And
first world problems. I can't lay down with my heavy tablet and read this book anywhere I want.
Yeah, but it strengthens your wrists, gets you ready for the Pathfinder core book.
Yeah. No, that's
Daddy,
a good...
Daddy, I want the book. You keep reading the tablet and strengthen those wrists.
No, but it's absolutely true, though. It's given the choice, I'll sit at my desk and read a PDF rather than sit down with a tablet. But also, I've lived my entire life in front of computers, so I'm comfortable here.
Right.
I'd prefer to... Actually, normally I prefer to read books, and that is certainly my preference, but because I watch a lot of TV shows online... I've started to grow roots in front of my desktop, so now I look at my PDFs on my desktop more versus my books.
Right.
Just because I can do both, because I'm now a product of the new millennia where I have no attention span.
I kind of feel that way too. But
some of my TV shows become radio plays because I'm like looking at something else while I'm listening to the character dialogue.
Getting back to what you were saying about the kind of Marvel subscription thing, I think that's kind of due to the nature of how you read a comic book versus how you interact with a game book, where, to run a game, like, I could see a someone coming up with a subscription service where you don't download the book. You just kind of are able to read it. But as you said, unless you then have access to your computer right there while you are playing the game, it's not going to be that useful.
But yeah, we know they do.
You reference it consistently.
No, but we know they do because they say 88% of the people play at somebody's home. And that person probably has Wi-Fi now. And the person most likely to want access would be the game master, and people generally play at that person's home.
Yeah, but probably. Is the desktop there in the gaming room?
It might not be, but I see what Lyle is saying. He's like...
It's all there. It's not like people are playing in the park.
Right. No. So, again, this might be a case of nobody has done it yet, and so people can't imagine what it would look like, but... With those numbers, you might be right. If somebody said, here's a subscription service to access all of whatever we have, and they make it, you know, slick and easy to navigate and intuitive, maybe people would use it.
Mm. Yeah.
So, I suppose the only other thing that I had on my list of things that were surprising was how small the number of people who play online is. And it was at only 7%.
Well, again, this could be because the tools are... still kind of in their infancy?
I don't know. There's been online... there hasn't been a really system-independent online kind of forum like Roll20, what we use. That's a fairly new thing. Before, they've kind of been proprietary Windows versus Mac and something you had to download and install and then set up with ports and whatnot. So it wasn't easily accessible like it is now, but they have been around for quite a while.
But the easy is the crux of the biscuit there.
Mm, true.
34% said both. 59% said face-to-face. Mm-hmm. So exclusively online, 7%. We've switched to exclusively online, but that's certainly not by choice.
Mm. Exactly, yeah.
And that's because, you have a new family. So that's certainly put restrictions on time. It's also put on places that we can play. Mm-hmm. We live in three different cities.
Which are not as far away as,
Oh, come on, three different cities.
All right, fine.
You live far away, Wayne. Very far away.
Not from my perspective.
Yeah. I'm not disagreeing with you, though, Chris. I was surprised by the small number, but maybe the perspective is exclusively and that people will always try to squeeze in a face-to-face, right. which moves them into the both category.
Right.
So...
Right.
I think it was Monty Cook when he wrote something about just the potential that he sees in online platforms for gaming. Uh-huh. And yeah, he certainly saw it as a way to deal with the problem of time and getting together.
Mm. Yeah. Well, I really think that online is probably one of the ways that the gaming as a hobby will survive because we do look to lose people. In the future, I don't think that the market is going to increase without some kind of big change in it, which I hope we can bring about. But I don't know. With online seems to be an easy way that you could get communities together and spread the word, but there don't seem to be that as many people interested in playing the game primarily online.
I think it's a way for people to meet and get with players.
Yeah,
especially when, like you say, with a shrinking community. You might not have the little school club that plays D&D or plays another role-playing game. Mm-hmm. So you're in a smallish town, and the only way you're going to be able to meet somebody with a similar interest is online.
Yeah,
people are going online to talk about different things, so it's not that far-fetched. The role-playing group I'm on or a part of at Facebook, every now and then somebody will post, I'm in the Los Angeles area, which is huge. So... But they're still posting online to see if there's any players that are interested in playing this game. Mm-hmm. So it's certainly replaced the...
Message board?
That little push board.
In the back of the magazine.
Sure, in the back of the magazine or just like the little notice board at the gaming store.
Yeah. No, I don't know. I kind of have mixed feelings because, this will just... We'll just have to wait and see what happens. But... if you're already sitting in front of a computer, it does bring you, closer or allow you to play with other people who are across the country, if I've done, or are on the other side of the world, if I've done a few times. But, the other thing of that is you're also sitting in front of the computer which is how you play WoW or any of these other, you know, massively multiplayer online games, which have kind of co-opted the RPG name, as we mentioned in the beginning, and why not just play that?
Yeah, and, you know, that's a really good point. I mean, Lyle said it a moment ago that we switched to online, but not by choice, because gaming face-to-face is a better experience, in my humble opinion.
Right. Like, I completely agree. And, like, I've run games online, and it was a conscious decision on my part to only use video and voice rather than to take advantage of all the things about being able to, like, throw up pictures and use audio and stuff like that. And part of the reason was because I felt the stuff I would be able to put up would not be as impressive as I wanted it to be, whereas you then go to a video game and those things are specifically developed to be visually and audio-ly impressive, you know?
Yes.
My brain fell out there for a second in terms of what to say for the sound, but yeah. I don't know, part of the appeal of playing face-to-face is interacting with people in a way that you can't online, and if the online tools are just going to try and mimic or try and compete with what video games do, I don't think they're going to be able to compete, and so why not just move over to video games?
Yeah, maybe it's a different discussion, but I kind of disagree on that.
Yeah, I'm going to have to disagree a little bit in that. Really quickly, is that we discussed what the last episode is. There are still certain things that a human can do,
right,
that a video game can't do. One thing is react to you doing something outside of its parameters.
Right.
Yeah. Now, a bad game master can still not react appropriately and say, okay, you're dead.
Yeah.
No, and a great video game can fake it, too.
Yeah. No, you can't go that way. Why not? Because I say so.
Yeah. Rocks.
Actually, that's very common. There's mountains. You can't go any further on the map.
Yep.
Oh, yeah. They were called the End of the World Mountains. Come on.
What's on the other side? Oh, geez, come on.
And I always try to climb them in every game.
All right. So after the first survey, certainly a lot of things jumped out, but perhaps the most significant thing was the thing that Chris mentioned, was the discrepancy in age. The age when people tended to start playing role-playing games versus the age of current players. So that shaped a lot of the questions in the second survey. So they were asking, like, what's appealing to kids? What is you think parents would let their kids play? And another thing that shaped it was something that I may have mentioned last episode, but if I didn't, it was this industry paper on collectible card games, which talked about how people who buy Magic cards at gaming stores are much older than people who buy Magic cards at a place like Walmart. So it showed that to attract younger people, you need to go to certain channels like Walmart as opposed to a gaming store, because that's what they're going to be. So you need products that Walmart is going to want to stock. So with these things in mind, like what would appeal to new players, what would appeal to younger players, what would a channel like Walmart want to stock, I developed a certain criteria or certain categories. Such as affordable, accessible profile means if somebody looked at it, would they go, oh, hey, I know what that game is. I know what Dungeons & Dragons is, even if they've never played it.
Right.
Whether or not they had simple rules, whether or not they're visually appealing, whether or not they're quick to start, and whether or not they would gain shelf space. So, you know, notice some of these are not surprising because we've talked about them in the last episode and this episode. And then chose certain games that were acting as stand-ins for that type of game, but certainly people could look at them just as that game. And they were a TRPG specifically designed for kids, Adventure Maximus, a TRPG like Pathfinder, an introductory box set. So use Pathfinder again. A D&D board game. So Wrath of a Shardalon.
Right.
Something that's more of a hybrid. Dungeons Command, so the miniature skirmish game, Pathfinder adventure game, so the card game, RPG hybrid, and then, of course, Magic as well. And then players were asked to rank them according to the criteria, or rate them according to the criteria. And this was to create what's called a perceptual map or a position map. And these are used to like visually display the perception of customers or consumers, and to see where products fall in a particular map, especially in relation to each other. Mm-hmm. If you can imagine, like, if you took a bunch of different car types and they had conservative versus sporty, affordable versus luxury, and then you put a bunch of, like, BMW versus Ford versus Dodge and Mercedes, and then see where they fall on the map, and then it gives people an idea of where their products fall or where there are openings for new products.
Hmm.
So that's what the position map is. But I use the 3D map, so I had a number of categories. So Wayne certainly commented on that the map itself is a little bit difficult to read, and it can be. It takes some getting used to.
So I was looking at like a 2D projection.
Yeah, of a 3D map.
Right.
Yeah, so the actual 3D map that I have, that's how it prints out. But what you get on the computer, you can rotate it around and look at it from the top, the bottom, and you start to see where the games are in relation to these different criteria.
Right, I can see like a 3D map would be really useful because you can see, okay, I see, you know, using this example, I see where Pathfinder falls on this map, I see where Magic falls on this map. But then, as you said, Lyle, you can like kind of turn this 3D model around and you can say, oh, hey, there's a gap right here.
Mm-hmm.
So let's design a product that, you know, kind of meets those criteria, and hopefully we'll fill that gap because we'll have a market for ourselves.
Yeah. Now, for people that like having trouble looking at it or reading the map, I mean, what you could do is you can actually just look at the numbers themselves that are provided, and that would show you that, for example, like Magic the Gathering, it would gain the most shelf space. You know, it's easy to stock. It flies off the shelf a lot. So, you know, a company like Walmart would be willing to stock that versus something that would sit on the shelf for a long time and may not sell.
Mm-hmm.
So you can do that, but you just don't get it at a glance. So
right. Yeah. No, because I look at the numbers and like I can see where things fall, but I can't identify where there are gaps.
So using what we've been doing for the two episodes, like what were things that didn't surprise you, and what were things that did surprise you about how people rated these different products?
One thing that didn't surprise me was how high people rated almost everything on this list as being visually appealing. That seemed to be pretty important, which, as I mentioned, didn't surprise me because noticing this thing, hey, it has to kind of be eye-catchy
mm-hmm.
for people to actually notice it. And so, yeah, these things got picked because they got noticed.
Okay, well, one question I have, and sorry I didn't actually think of it until now, was since we're talking about shelf space here, why do you have the PDFs on there? Is that to account for kind of digital sales as well?
Yeah, like a digital retailer, in my mind, thinking more Amazon than DriveThruRPG, because DriveThruRPG specializes in these, but
mm-hmm.
I would imagine that there are certain algorithms or a certain strategy on what products appear.
Mm.
Certainly in the recommendations, of course, that's gets into what you look at, but also what they would recommend and things like that.
Well, yeah, I mean, definitely, like, the page rank, I suppose, what would come at eye level on a shelf is usually based off of relevance, so whatever metadata has been supplied by the publisher. So that's more into keywords that they've put in their products. But, of course, it would be weighted on how popular the product is. Those would float higher. But, yeah, when it comes to recommended products, that would almost be entirely based off of metadata, both from the supplier and from the store.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
That's a good point. Now, you talking about PDFs, Chris, you listed both the Adventure Maximus PDF as well as the Adventure Maximus print and PDF bundle, Lyle, as well as the Pathfinder Core rulebook in both PDF and hardback forms. And in both of those cases, there was a pretty significant drop-off between affordability. Like,
yeah.
the affordability on both the PDF versions was pretty high in both products, and then took a significant hit when you looked at the print or print and PDF version.
Almost 40% for a Pathfinder, hey?
But we were looking at a jump of $20 in the case of Adventure Maximus and a jump of $40 in the case of Pathfinder. And in both cases, I think buying the print also gives you the PDF, if that makes a difference.
Mm.
But yeah, I guess that's a pretty, especially $40, that's a pretty significant jump.
Right.
Yeah. Well, no, I think we discussed it last episode as well. But for me, $10 and maybe $15 is enough for me to say, yeah, whatever. I'll just buy it just because I want it. Mm. But when you get over that, when you get into $20 plus, it starts to be something that I actually have to want before I will consider buying it.
Yeah. Right. What's it? The Yoshinoya. For people, they make a thing called gyudon, which is like a beef bowl, which is like rice with beef and onions on top.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And they, I believe, still have a one coin policy, and it's a 500 yen coin.
Right, so about $5. Yeah,
about $5. So it's the largest coin. And I suppose there's been, you know, studies on this, but probably like if you have a coin, you're more likely to spend it than you would a bill.
Right.
So they didn't want to have any dishes that were more than like the one coin, or at least the core dishes shouldn't be more than one coin.
Right. 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 Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've been here nearly 8 years, and I still kind of think of the 100 yen coins as quarters because they look very much like U.S. quarters. And then sometimes,
oh, ditto, man.
Yeah, sometimes I'm
so
like, yeah,
that.
Hey, that was a buck, not 25 cents.
Yeah. But
I know when we did the Numenera thing, I said $20 for a PDF is about as high as I'm willing to go, and unless it's pretty massive. And Numenera, I felt was, well, I mean, The game factored into this as well, but was more than I wanted to spend after getting the product, where I recently purchased Mind Jammer PDF, which is a massive 500-page thing, and that was about $26. But because it was so massive, it was a bit of an investment, but 500 pages, I don't know, I was a bit more comfortable paying over $25 for that.
Yeah. Well, one thing that didn't surprise me was that Magic it rated the highest in gaining shelf space. Mm. And that's what I mentioned that before. So,
well, I think a lot of factors go into that. Like Magic is practically a household name, and I think retailers know that, and I think the people who answered this survey know that. And so, of course, it's going to get rated highly in gain shelf space.
Well, in profile, it stomped over all the other products.
Yeah, I mean, it's like Wayne said, it's a household name, and it's you know, a starter pack is pretty cheap. It's not that expensive to get into. Once you're into it, it's quite a different story,
right?
Yeah.
But the rules aren't that complicated. Again, to get started with, though, they can build later on, and the art is good. You know,
yeah, and it's also accessible. Rated very low in play pattern, TRPG play pattern.
I would be surprised if it hadn't rated lowest in traditional role-playing game play pattern, because it's not an RPG.
Sure, Dungeon Command rated low, or second lowest, and yeah, I don't know, I can't really see that as being more role-playing-esque than Magic. People are unfamiliar with Dungeon Command, because I don't think they even make it anymore. It was like skirmish-based miniatures game, using D&D miniatures, so...
I think it also probably used maybe like, I think the reason it rated higher than Magic despite being a miniatures game is they probably carried over a lot of the stats, abilities, and races, classes, monster types from D&D.
Fair enough. I do know that Wrath of Ashardlon I thought was a nice introduction to 4th edition Dungeons & Dragons because it looks so similar.
Right, a lot of the mechanics were the same.
Yeah, so...
No, I definitely agree, and I think people did too, because that rated fairly high on TRPG play pattern.
Yeah. So a key takeaway I got from the perceptual data was there's definitely room for hybrid games, and just what kind of hybrid games you want to make. Or if not hybrid games, but that the games can definitely borrow from each other.
Mm-hmm.
To make a game that would be more appealing to kids, that would be like an RPG.
True.
We did look at, there was a follow-up question that related to the perceptual data, and that was, and one of the reasons why to elicit the perceptual data, not only to get that position map, but also then to lead into this question about what would be the kind of the best TRPG core sets in terms of whether or not children age 12 would want to buy them or receive them.
Mm-hmm.
And because it included things like TRPG board game hybrids, TRPG CCG hybrid, TRPG miniatures game hybrid. So. And the ones that did really well were like introductory box set.
Yeah. So just a plain old introductory box set is people thought that would be most useful for kids age 8 to 12, or they'd be the happiest getting it as opposed to other things.
Kids love being able to hold stuff.
Yeah. I mean, standard printed core book ranked did pretty well. That was simplified introductory version of a printed core book did all right as well. But I don't know, 8 to 12 to receive something like Pathfinder? I don't know. It's a bit difficult.
Mm.
Yeah. So I think I was both surprised and not surprised by how... I mean, they didn't do terrible, the hybrid games, but I thought they would have done a little bit better.
Well, I mean, if you look at this, the first, with 14 votes, the introductory boxed set was highest. And then it looks like the second was a traditional role-playing game and collectible card game hybrid starter pack with 9 votes at number one.
Yeah, when you look at the number one, so people like really committed to that.
Hmm.
But then something like, yeah, like the simplified version didn't receive as many number one votes, but received more votes overall.
Yeah.
So, yeah, but yeah, people definitely committed to the TRPG CCG hybrid one. But I honestly expected that to do even better. Just because of the price point so low.
Right, right. So. But again, if it's kind of like, oh, well, I suppose the question was, would want to buy or receive as a gift? And then price does matter. That may have been, I don't know, data here may have been skewed a little bit in terms of people picking stuff based on what they thought would be good introductions to the RPG hobby, which is maybe why the introductory box set rated so high.
Oh, and I think some people pointed out is like kids don't care how much something costs if right. they're going to receive it. So it could have been a flaw in the question itself, is that included the prices, but kids don't really care.
Right.
So it didn't factor in, like, is the parent going to be reluctant to buy a $30 box set versus a $15 starter pack?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But I think we've had introductory box sets, and I know I said earlier in the episode that we had them, and there was kind of a long period where we didn't have them, and now they have a resurgence.
Right.
I don't know. Where do you guys see that? Do you think that that's not necessarily the savior, but is that still a good way to introduce people to the game? Is it going to work? Did it work before?
Well, I'd be really reluctant to think of it as something that's going to save the hobby or turn the numbers around, but I do think that it is a really great way of introducing somebody to the hobby. Here's a box full of cool little things that are this great new game that you can get into, and this is everything you need to get into it. So have fun.
Yeah.
And I you know, I how much more excited if you picture yourself as a whatever 8-year-old kid to get a box instead of a book full of stuff.
I think that it applies to anybody, because I mean, like, it may not be the savior of the hobby, but like as we've looked at the data, the number of kids under 18 who answered the survey are pretty low, especially when you compare that to the number or to the age when people who are playing the game started playing, where it's like they started playing at 12 and pretty much nobody under the age of 18 answered the survey. So there's something wrong there. And as we said in the beginning, we can't just rely on parents introducing their kids. And with all the competition from video games and all this other stuff, books are still appealing, but maybe more appealing is, hey, here is this box set that has everything you need to play. Maybe it's a little bit stripped down, but any dice you need to play, they're in the box. Pre-made characters are in the box. Tokens are in the box. Maps are in the box. We have made this thing where all you need to do is crack it open, read a couple of pages, and you can start playing, rather than here is this 500-page book that you have to read about probably at least half of to understand how to play. So yep. While they may not be the savior, I think they are definitely important to growing the hobby.
I am going to disagree, but not for the argument that you're making, which I think is a really good argument for why we can't rely on the traditional model of here's a core book, here are supplements to the core book. Where I think maybe the introductory box set doesn't go far enough.
Okay.
And really looking at what is something that we can introduce to these new gamers that has, if not identical to a TRPG play pattern, but very similar to, or enough that it's an easy leap.
Mm-hmm.
And is really fun, visual appealing, and easy to start up. I think an introductory box set, and again, it gets into who's answering versus how they started, versus what could appeal to kids now, and an introductory box set is what people are used to, And certainly a lot of lessons have been learned by the companies in that they do look better and it looks like they offer more, but I'm not sure if that's the best way. I think that companies should still keep experimenting with these hybrid games. And maybe Wrath of Ashardalon, for example, didn't work because it was too expensive or something, but it actually seemed like something that a kid would get into more than the Pathfinder box set. You had little toys to play with. You could actually play it by yourself.
Yeah, that's a big point, too.
Yeah.
Because then you can play while learning the rules instead of needing somebody else to.
The rules were actually a little bit more complicated than I would like for a kid. But the rulebook's certainly smaller than the like a rulebook you get in an introductory box set.
Right.
So I'm agreeing with one half of your argument. I just think the company should keep experimenting. So Pathfinder with the adventure game, yeah, I hope that works out for you because that looks like something that kids might like.
Well, have you guys seen the I think they were, I forget the name of it, maybe like Pathfinder, not Adventure Paths. They were the Game Mastery, maybe like map packs or something like that.
Yeah, anyway. Map packs, card packs, yeah.
Yeah, but what these were is it was a pack that was going to be kind of like an adventure module.
I know what you're talking about,
it came with about 3 or 4 miniatures. And the idea was, here are major NPCs for this adventure. In this pack, you get a couple of battle maps and the module to run. And these were for Pathfinder. And if you took an idea like that and said, here is your character figure, and inside this pack is going to be, and maybe there's like a major NPC figure as well that you're going to end up fighting at the end of this, but this pack contains, you know, your figure, maybe some tokens, a little solo adventure that you can play through, a couple battle maps, as well as, you know, enough rules so you get the foundation of the game down. I could see something like that maybe fitting or filling the niche you're mentioning, Lyle.
Certainly with, like a TRPG miniatures hybrid or something like that, yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, that concludes our episode on the industry survey. Of course, we couldn't get into everything, but you have access to all the information. Things that I thought were really interesting that we didn't get into because, I mean, you can read what the people put in their own words. I cleaned up some of the spelling, except for one I'm looking at now. So I'll have to fix that. And that's just like, what do you think TRPG companies need to do to attract new players or new customers? So some people didn't know, but like tried, but I thought people had some really good ideas there.
Hopefully they'll get used.
Yeah, I hope so.
Well, that was what we thought was surprising and not surprising about the results, but you may disagree, or you may. So we'd certainly love to hear from you.
Yep. All right, well, thank you for joining us again on Idle Red Hands. Check us out online at www.idleredhands.com, idleredhands.com. You can listen to the episode right there on the website, or stream it through Stitcher or iTunes, or download it off of DriveThruRPG. You can also plus one us on Google Plus, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, join up in our forums, which are at idleredhands.com/forums, and are hosted by Happy Jacks. Thank you very much, guys. Or just send us an email at info@idleredhands.com. Thank you very much, and see you next time.
Bye.
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 I just think it's Hot Topic have those like sex novelty things.
Not really. You're thinking of Spencer's Toys and Gifts.
Oh, okay. All right. So Hot Topic is just like t-shirts.
Hot Topic is, remember on South Park, all like the vampire kids go to get all their goth gear. Yeah. That's Hot Topic.
Lots of black t-shirts, friends help you move, real friends help you move bodies, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Okay.
They sell angst.
Yeah.
Drive-through RPG. We average 9 new titles a day. That's over 60 a week. And we've got well over 15,000 RPG titles online right now. Drive-Thru RPG, the one true source for RPGs.
Idle Red Hands, recorded in Kobe, Japan. See us online at www.idleredhands.com. Music provided by Tripod Jimmy, and the song was Roadkill. Hope you enjoyed it. See you next time.